702.
The Naked Scientist.
Time for The Naked Scientist, Dr. Chris Smith. Happy Monday, Dr. Chris Smith. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm glued to the Olympics. Are you?
I was about to say, I'm so curious as to your thoughts so far, because I am wondering, Doctor, just from a science perspective, what is that thing that happens scientifically on the day of a match or a big game that propels an athlete to do better than they've ever done before? What is that thing?
Power of mind.
Is it adrenaline?
Power of mind,
power
exactly,
of the
adrenaline,
mind.
Yeah. There's a thing called the winner effect, which is that people who are on a winning streak and have got themselves into the mindset that this is my day and every day is their day, they will perform much better. And so that's a healthy helping of psychology. It also increases your hormone tone. The excitement around the event pushes out a lot more adrenaline, and adrenaline also makes sure your muscular system work better, or at least as tip-top as it can. It also increases your metabolic rate, so you are producing as much energy as you can. So there's a whole range of different things that all come together, and what an athlete's looking to do is to make sure all of these things, all their clocks are ticking in sync, as it were. Everything is aligned. The stars are even aligned for them, and a lot of thought goes into that, because you think some athletes will have travelled across big time zones. Now, South Africa is very lucky because it's on the same time zone as what Europe's operating on. But for some athletes, they're going to have to suffer a complete inversion of their body clock, because they're coming from a time zone where they might be hours behind. So they have to think about that, because if you don't allow your body clock time to realign with the right clock in the area you're going to be running, all of your tissues are running their own clock, and that means they're turning their metabolic rate up to when it thinks you're going to need to be working at your best, which is going to be the wrong time zone for when you're doing your race. So that has to be thought about as well. So there's an enormous amount of planning, strategy, and other things that help behind the scenes that all these athletes are going through, and which has all been informed by science, right through from what you eat and what you drink to when you eat, when you drink, when you practice, when you sleep, and how you sleep, and what sort of conditions you sleep in. All these things make a huge difference to your ability to prepare for a big race and then be really, really fresh and ready for it on the day.
Okay, and I think what is the lesson that we can take out of what athletes do in terms of their preparation and routine that we can incorporate into our daily lives? Because we don't all need to wait for the stakes to be so high to get the best out of ourselves.
Well, probably the best thing to say is that, as one heart doctor put it to me, that if you could turn the benefits you get from even modest amounts of exercise and being active physically into a pill, you would have the world's most powerful medicine, because there is no pill that is as good as the effects of physical activity. Because if you think about it, not only are you moving and that's good for your body, but you're also socializing, because when you go out and do things that are team sports and so on, you also reap all the rewards of being with other people. And we know that doing things together also confers a huge health benefit to us. So the thing to take away from the Olympics is, these are team sports, these are people working together, these are people who are being very physically active. Let's all be a bit more physically active to the greatest extent we can without killing ourselves, because we'll all get huge health rewards from it. We'll all be a bit thinner, we'll all be a bit fitter, we'll also be a bit happier.
There we go. All right, your questions. This one comes through from Temba, who says, Dr. Chris, how do you explain deja vu of having memories of having lived a different experiences or a past life, like you were someone else before you were who you are now?
Hi, Temba. I won't make the crappy joke about have we had this one before. I'm sure we've had already answered that. We've been down that path before.
We literally have.
No, we have. I'm sure we have. We have, haven't we? And now I'm having deja vu.
I think we have.
The answer is that the way our brain works and the way it records memory is a very specialized process. And there are a whole raft of things that can create abnormal memories or fool us into thinking we are attaching significance to something we shouldn't. And tiredness can do this. Some forms of brain problem like epilepsy can do this. And just normal life and stress and being busy can do this. So we're continually being vigilant to look out for things that we recognize and can then compare with our memories in order to inform how we do everything better Because from an evolutionary point of view, if you've made a mistake once that nearly cost you your life, you don't want to make it again. So we've become very good at learning from our past experiences. So the brain is continuously, aggressively probing our experiences and asking, have I seen this before? Have I seen this before? And occasionally you can get some aberration neurologically that makes you think, yeah, I'm sure I have. I'm sure I've done this before. And you have some memories that kind of get a bit orphaned in your brain, but then they get some tag of significance attached to them. So you think they apply to you, and they might also fall outside the normal timeline, because our brain has a way of having a life timeline attached to all our memories, so that you can think forwards and backwards in time. You know what you're going to do in the future, and you know those things haven't happened yet. You can also look back in your life and know when those things happened, they happened to you, and relative to what else. And that can occasionally get distorted or disrupted temporarily or sometimes permanently. So we do attach false significance to memories. And as I say, stress, tiredness, and certain brain conditions can make that more likely to happen.
702.
The Naked Scientist.
We continue with The Naked Scientist. Dr. Chris Smith is taking all of your science-related questions. 011-883-0702 and the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. We go to Patrick from Germiston. Patrick, go ahead.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
Wet and dry macular degeneration of someone's eye. I've been told to have spinach. And what is it in spinach that helps with it? And why is it like green things like that?
Hi, Patrick. First of all, what's macular degeneration? Well, the macula is the central point of your vision, where your vision is at its most acute. So when you're looking across a room at someone's face to recognize who they are, you're using your macula. When you're watching the television, you're using your macula. When you're reading a book and trying to read the fine print in your insurance documents, you're using your macula. That's where the density of receptors, the cones that convert light waves effectively into brain waves, is greatest. So your resolution of vision is greatest in that place. And if you lose those photoreceptors in your retina, and they can be lost for a range of reasons, then you will damage your ability to see so clearly in that region. So things aren't quite so crystal clear. And when we get older, we are more likely to fall victim to the degeneration of that part of the eye, hence macular degeneration. But when eye doctors look into that part of the eye, they see that it comes in broadly two flavours, what we call wet macular degeneration and dry macular degeneration. And they can be told apart by their appearance and also the mechanism of what causes them. And because they are down to two slightly different mechanisms, although both common in older age, the treatments are slightly different. With wet macular degeneration, there is a proliferation of new blood vessels often, and they tend to become leaky, and the leakiness can also turn into hemorrhages and bleeding, and these things can starve the retina of blood even more, which makes even more new blood vessels occur, which can make the problem compound itself even more. And so you can see why that's a vicious cycle that can damage things. In dry macular degeneration, there is the buildup of other abnormal substances in the back of the eye, but the effect is the same. It starves the retina of the nutrition that blood vessels normally bring, and this leads to the loss of the rods and cones, but chiefly cones in the macula, which leads to sight loss. Now, in terms of stopping that happening, there are some general lifestyle things that tend to go along with the lowest likelihood of it occurring. And there's an old saying that healthy body, healthy brain, because your brain has the highest metabolic rate pretty much of any organ in your body, weight for weight. It has a huge blood flow through it because it has such a high metabolic rate. And therefore, healthy blood vessels are crucial to a healthy brain. Why am I talking about the brain when we're considering eyes? Because the retina is actually an outgrowth or an extension of the brain. And during development, our brain develops, and then our optic nerves grow out from the underlying brain and form the retina. So the retina is effectively brain tissue. And it too is very high in metabolic rate, very dependent on a healthy blood supply. Therefore, things that keep blood vessels and blood supply healthy go along with keeping your retina healthy. The best thing you can do is never smoke, or if you do smoke, try not to smoke. And if you can't not smoke at all, cut down the amount you smoke, because smoking is one of the worst things you can do for any tissue in your body, but especially brain health. And also maintaining healthy blood pressure and healthy blood vessels. And one way to do that is to have as healthy a diet as you possibly can. And part of that is having lots of fresh green leafy vegetables, because they have antioxidants in the right context that we've evolved to absorb them, and also make them available to your tissues in the right sort of way. So they tend to go along with keeping your blood vessels as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And then treat other reversible things. Be active. We talked about physical activity at the beginning when we were discussing the Olympics. Physical activity is really important and helps to maintain a lower blood pressure. So keeping your blood pressure under control is also crucial to keeping a healthy heart and healthy blood vessels, and therefore a healthy brain.
Thank you so, so much for that question. Another question that has come through, and I don't know how we answer this one, Doctor. Can one be in two places at the same time? For instance, being in one place and also be in other places, say, in another country. And I'm not sure where the question's coming from, but that's how we got it.
Well, there is a phenomenon in physics called entanglement, and maybe that's what the person is getting at. And Einstein was very dismissive of this idea and actually called it spooky action at a distance, because he didn't believe it could happen, but then subsequently changed his mind. And scientists have proven this is absolutely the case. So it's a quantum mechanical phenomenon whereby if I have a particle, say a photon of light, a packet of light, and I entangle it with another photon of light, so they share a particular piece of information, I can move them to distances across the universe apart from one another, and if I change one of them, it makes the other one change as well. And we don't understand how this works. As I say, there's something at the quantum level where these things become entangled in some way, but we don't know what that is, and it seems to transcend vast distances. So that may be one way that you can effectively be in two places at once, because you have a counterpart, a mirror image counterpart, or a clone of yourself, which is entangled with you, and you're in two places. You change one, you change the other. But in terms of us at the macro scale, no, we're not going to be in two places at the same time. And therefore, you can't, although we might wish to be in two places at once. I've been very many circumstances where I'd like to be somewhere else. But also, there have been times when I've wanted to be in the same place as well. It's a nice idea, but it isn't possible.
I hear you there, Dr. Chris Smith, and your questions on the WhatsApp line.
Good afternoon, Dr. Chris. My name is Imelda. I'd like to find out, Sutherland in the Northern Cape, how come always its temperatures are very extreme? They are not similar to the towns in and around it. Like it will be -8 or those extreme temperatures, and the other towns around Sutherland are not like that. Or what's happening in Sutherland?
This is a good point, because it points to the phenomenon of how weather occurs and local temperatures, and it's all about your geography. Because if you are close to the sea, then your temperature is very much fixed to what the sea is doing. And in summer, it's usually nice and warm if the ocean's warm, unless you are in Cape Town, where the ocean's always cold, and because it's come from Antarctica, and therefore it tends to have a cooling effect. But you are very much leveraged, or your temperatures are leveraged by what the local ocean temperatures are doing. And as the sea warms up with summertime, it will warm you up. So that's part of it. Also, the terrain really matters. If you've got lots of big mountains near you, then they're very exposed. They will trap cold air at their top, which will come falling down the side of the mountain. And if the geography of the land is in a bowl at the bottom of the mountain, the cold air can fall there. And because colder air is denser air, it will sink and sit. So you can end up sitting there in a bowl of freezing cold air, and all of the areas around you that are slightly higher than you won't be in that freezing cold air, because it will have overflowed and gone downhill some other route, like a river, effectively, and they're much warmer. So we know this happens, because there have been instances where people have made campsites in mountainous regions and perished because freezing cold air collected in this bowl region and made all the people freeze to death, and those who were further away were absolutely fine. You can spot them in alpine regions, for example, because there are often no trees there, because this phenomenon kills anything that tries to grow, like a tree in that sort of region. So I'd say it's probably a combination of the nature of the terrain and proximity or distance, as it is, to oceans.